All of you this evening. How's the sound? It's kind of getting echo a little bit, right? Maybe turn it down a little bit? Yeah. How's this? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, good. Somebody say no? Okay. All right, everybody can hear me okay? All right. I'm starting to notice that Christians are kind of moving out of the mainstream these days. It's hard to see people because everybody's over in the... I have to start having layers of chairs this way instead of cushions. So this talk this evening is going to be a bit of a stretch. It's what got me to come to this practice, to awaken, rather than to have a little bit of relief or ease. And then next week I'll come back down to earth and we can talk about working with emotions. But I hope that it's useful for you anyway. I think there's a lot of aspects of it that are very much in this day-to-day life we live, and we really need to work with both, with the underlying psychological aspects that drive our life, as well as... we don't need to work with the other part, but from my perspective, that's what this place is all about, ultimately, is to awaken, to be free, whatever that means. So I'd like to start by, I know some of you have been sitting for quite a while, but just close your eyes lightly. And just sort of kind of this question of where are you? Not in some intellectual center of, well, I'm in Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, but how do you know where you are? And at some level there's, you know, perhaps the feeling of the buttocks on the cushion or chair, the breathing process. But see, maybe you can sense this presence, a sense of here-ness that doesn't have any location. And then, well, I'll just stay with that for a second. So we're not really focusing on any particular part of the body, just this kind of here. And then notice that there's a knowing quality. We could call it awareness. It doesn't take any effort. And it could be a knowing quality that's about your mind-body process. And also notice that there's this quality of knowing that can be aware of what you might think of as you. So in some sense, this knowing quality is both inside and outside. It doesn't really have a location. Okay? So I just want to sort of offer that as maybe giving a little bit of physicality to what I want to talk about tonight. So this title, No Subject, No Object, No Separation, actually came from my first Dai Shishin, which Dai Shishin is in Japanese, Dai means great, Shishin's kind of intensive retreat, out at Mount Baldy, California, quite some time ago. And the Zen master, Joshu Sasaki Roshi, was, I guess in my time period of practicing out there, was between 85 and 90. I went out there 4 or 5 times. And he talked about the greatest weakness of Westerner practitioners, and I don't think it's just Westerners, but since he was here, he probably chose to pick on us, was a sense of someone outside the experience. In some sense, this is a direct pointing to an aspect of what we might call awakening. And actually, he said, "No subject, no no subject, no object, no separation." And he called that true love. And after a very intensive retreat, I called my wife and told her I survived. And after I tell you a little bit about what it's like to go out there, you might appreciate that. But I was so touched by this. What it would be like to meet her, not wanting anything, totally present, no views, opinions, just this quality of empathy, of tenderness, which is really a part of something we all have. I was really touched by it. And we've had these moments. It's like when all the personality drops away, all the stories, all the views, all the wanting. There's something so intimate, so precious. It's experience where there's no now, there's no future, no past. It's just utter presence. And this might not make sense to people. Well, of course there's a me and there's a you. And we are separate and we have needs. But this whole subject-object mentality, this relationship, is really deeply embedded in our language. It's part of our neurosystem. The neurosystem interprets that there's a me. We separate from ourselves, our mind, our body. You know, they're separate things. There's this inner critic who tells you should be better. If you just tried harder, you would be more. And there's this part of you that's totally inadequate. Anybody have that? But where are they? Is it? Huh? Okay. You have that? Okay. So, I mean, where is it? It's all inside. One part of mind talking to the other part of mind. I mean, this is like really helpful. Not that there's some you outside who's the inner critic who can control things, but the you that's criticizing the inadequate you is the same thing. They're just little programs running. Now, we have this visual experience. You know, I'm sitting here and there are these images out here. Really quite amazing images, actually. And there's the neurosystem says, well, they're a certain distance apart. They're out there and I'm here. But that's an inference. And when you think about where the visual image is actually taking place, photons, as far as we know from physics, is they go through the eye, and an image is created in the back of the head, not out there. And people who are born blind and have their sight restored, at first, their response is they don't want to be able to see. It's so confusing. There's no ability to separate out. It's a learned experience. You might think I'm giving this talk, but I'm actually totally off track of what I thought I was going to say. It unfolds. Now, I could have written it all down and, you know, but I don't like to do that. Just, okay, what's going to happen? That this mind-body complex manifests itself. Life lives itself. But we think that there's this neurosystem thinks that there's a me who has to control, run the show. So I want to come at this from two approaches. One is my time practicing out at Mount Baldy Zen Center, which is in California. It's about 6,000 feet elevation. They have a bunch of cabins. It's an old Boy Scout camp. They have like eight people in a cabin with bunks, an outhouse, scorpions. You get up at 2:30 in the morning. First sitting's at 3. Takes about 10, 15 minutes to get to the Zendo, so you can imagine how much time you have to brush your teeth and all that sort of thing. And you get about 20 minutes to yourself during the day. Everything is form. And there's a Jikki Jitsu who's kind of like a father image. I'm not that kind of father, but an image some of us have about a father image. He's always on your case. You know, maybe your robe's not on right. Maybe your feet aren't flat on the floor while you're eating. Maybe you're supposed to be chanting and you're actually doing something else. I mean, if I got through a half day without this guy on my case, it felt like a pretty good morning, you know. Even showers, you get to take one, I think, during the whole Daishishin, the nine-day Daishishin. They're group showers. They march you down, and they say, in, you have a certain amount of time, and they say, out showers, and then they march you back. So that's kind of the framework. So I want to talk about the experience of a few people, but let me just step back for a moment about this whole language thing, is that we turn processes into nouns. We think we're something solid. I'm like this, I'm not like this. But really we are. We're just this kind of conceptual process that's going on, this emotional process that's going on, this bodily process that's going on, and they interact with each other. And they're intelligent processes they can learn. So rather, when you kind of start telling a story about yourself, realize that story is a little program running. It's a process, and it affects the body, it affects the emotional standpoint. So you bring this quality of awareness to all this, to see it, to step back. This is a wonderful quality human beings have, all of us. Just step back and know what's going on, not to identify the process. So one more thing about this subject-object orientation. I was in a cabin with probably seven other people who had all been to India, were philosophy majors, and they told Joshua that they came here to study Zen, and Joshua would get up and rant and say, Zen is not an object. It's an activity. Life is an activity. It's not an object. And so much of the profound wisdom of the Buddha himself, who really didn't want to go to conceptualizations of what we are, but to bring us to the direct experience of this very now moment of Nagarjuna, who deconstructed language, of Dogen, is to get us out of this conceptual framework that we live in, that we're not here in this vibrant life, this moment-to-moment life. So I want to start by telling a story about a guy named Rami Shapiro. It was actually written in Tricycle some time ago. Rami Shapiro was studying to be a rabbi, and he came to Mount Baldy Zen Center with kind of a naive idea of what it was going to be like. So I left out one part of the description of this practice. Four times a day, you meet the Zen master, and you have to manifest a koan. Now, koan's like kind of a conundrum, a question that has no intellectual answer. It's trying to get you out of your head. So you can imagine going in there four times a day with the same koan, and you have to run from this cabin. This is at 6,000 feet. Do three prostrations, and then manifest the koan. So Rami goes in, and he has this notion he's going to talk with Joshua about God. And he realizes that Joshua is talking to him. And he says, doesn't he understand I don't speak Japanese? And then he realizes he's actually speaking English. He's got an accent. And he says, where is God when stick hits floor? And Rami says, God is here. And he rings the bell and sends them off, which is how it works. You don't have the right answers, they just send you off. So he comes back and he says, God is here, God is everywhere. He gets sent off again. So then he tries a little Nagarjuna. God is here, God is everywhere, God is not here, God is both here and not here. I don't remember all the different logistics. God is neither here nor not here. And he sends him off. So then he tries a haiku. Doesn't work. Okay, ring, boom. So you can imagine this is going on day after day, four times a day, utter frustration. And this is actually, I think, worth reading his description of what happened after that. Because I had the same idea. I'm really happy I didn't do it. Although I didn't have as much expectations as Rami had about it. He said, thus far, I'd focused my answers on the universality of God when stick hit floor. But what I had to do was to show Roshi, Roshi is the name of a teacher, it means teacher, that the stick was irrelevant. God was, is, and always will be, whether the stick hits the floor or not. How could I demonstrate this deep insight? So he really thinks he's got it, right? He says, by grabbing that little stick and ripping the sucker out of the old man's hand. And, you know, he actually reasons, like, I'm bigger than him. He's not going to be expecting it. He goes in and he positions himself to grab the stick. I thought about doing the same thing, because after a while, you got to come up with something, right? So, he said, my stick, my God, my answer. My God, I'm brilliant. So he goes in and he positions himself. And Joshua says, where is God when stick hits floor? And Rami grabs the stick. But Joshua's built like a little fire plug. I mean, he's a little old guy, but he flips Rami over his head. And Rami said, my body was bruised and my ego was bruised, and I swore I'd never come back. Now, it's really hard to leave Mount Baldy because there's no transportation. You're up there, right? So he tells this story about how he ends up coming back. He doesn't know how. Now, I don't know how you could possibly wander in, given how I've described how things work there, but he says he did. And he says, I flung myself at his feet, screaming at the top of my lungs, God is here. I suspect that is what happened, because when I regained awareness, I was lying next to Roshi, my throat raw, and my ears still ringing with the scream, steal the stick. No stick, no sound, just God. And he looks up and Josh is laughing hysterically. So I had a similar koan. My first koan was, where have you been now? And he was hitting a stick on the floor. And I went in for about 3 days, so that's 12 times ringing the bell, kind of dumb intellectual answers. And then Joshua said to me, you will never be free as long as you go down the mind road. And this is actually what got me into this practice. There was a line from a Zen master in a book called A Way of Awareness. No, what was it called? I can't remember. There's a line from a Zen master that said, thinking will get you nowhere. And somehow it just resonated with me. When we come to this practice, we really need some faith. And it might come from, for me, it was a line, thinking will get you nowhere, because I've explored all this existential philosophy and all that sort of stuff, and I decided, you can go anywhere if you just make the right set of assumptions. So it might be, for you, faith might be all the quantitative evidence that meditation helps, or you know somebody who's gotten somewhere. But it takes a certain faith to actually put the energy into this. And then I realized, I came in, I don't know if I was even thinking about it, but I just hit my fist on the floor when he hit the stick on the floor. All he wanted Rami to do, all he wanted me to do, is be totally present with the direct experience of the sound of the stick hitting the floor. And that's a lot, in some sense, what this whole practice is about, to be aware of the direct experience, this non-judgmental knowing quality, not adding anything to it. As Larry Rosenberg says, don't add heat, don't add cold, just experience it. And after that, we got along really well. I mean, he would come in and he'd just say, enjoy the flowers. So he just wanted me just to see the flowers. Not to think they're beautiful or anything, just the scene. And then he would bang the stick on the floor just to make sure I wasn't lost in thought or something. So there's a couple other stories I just want to touch on. Joseph Goldstein, who many of you may be aware of, told a story about he was practicing with Joshua Sasaki and how he'd come in and get sent off. And Joshua would tell him it was stupid. And then he said, you know, Joshua must have felt sorry for me because he just gave me this chant to do. And so Joseph went back and he's sitting and he's just practicing this chant over and over again. And he goes into Joshua and he totally blows it. He can't chant. He just says the wrong things, mixes it all up. And Joshua said, that's very good. Joseph was, you know, he was being Joseph, showing his vulnerability. Not this willful sense of having to be somebody, not having to show he's smart, a good Zen Center student. And Joseph actually said afterwards that Joshua couldn't have known this, but when I was in school, in the choir, my teacher told me to mouth it. He couldn't sing. There's another story about Ram Dass. Ram Dass was for those who don't know him, was a real spiritual leader in the 70s, did some LSD trips and things, I guess. And I guess he was at Harvard and left and explored things. And, you know, Ram Dass went there and they just treated him. He was pretty well known by then. They just treated him like anybody else. Das Kevin 6, which is where they put all the newbies. And so Ram Dass goes in and gets the same treatment. I'm really disappointed in you, Dr. Dass. So finally Ram Dass gets sick. And he doesn't care anymore. And he goes in to see Joshua. And Joshua says, welcome, Dr. Zen. You're now a beginning Zen student. So he's really just this very simple training of just being here, what we are, without adding all these images, trying to be good enough, trying to impress, the things that keep us from really connecting. And I just want to say one more thing, and then I'm going to kind of talk about this from more Theravadan tradition. It was really intense, and yet it was so alive. You just had to be present all the time because somebody was going to jump on your butt if you weren't. And there was an aliveness to it, vibrancy. But we move up into our heads into perceptions rather than seeing things directly, knowing exactly what we're doing. Okay. So I want to tell a story about it's called the Bahia Sutta. Sutta is a discourse. And in the Theravadan tradition, Bahia is known as the fastest awakening that's ever happened in a Buddha's time. So listen carefully. It's a chance. So Bahia was living on the coast of India. And he's called Bahia the bark cloth because he just wore bark. He was an ascetic. well-respected practitioner, and he asked himself the question whether he was awakened or not. And the story is that Deva came. Deva is like a minor god, and said, "You, Bahia, are neither an arahant," which is an awakened person, "nor have you entered into a path of an arahant. You don't even have a practice whereby you would ever become an arahant or enter into the path." So this Deva is saying, you're not even close. You're not even going down the right path. Now, you could interpret this as he had this internal voice that sort of knew that. And yet he's not defensive. I mean, you can imagine a teacher telling you, your practice just like totally deluded, which is what mine was, actually. Narayana was really much nicer than Zen masters. She told me I was very earnest, which I thought was a good thing, but I was very deluded earnest. So he, without hesitation, leaves, doesn't say goodbye to anybody. And the story is that overnight he travels to see the Buddha, which is like, in a way, you could do that overnight. But it's a sense of spiritual urgency. And he finds the Buddha, and he's on alms round. And he says, but he asks him, you got to tell me how to be awakened. And he says, I can't do this. I'm on alms round. And in India, the tradition is if you ask three times, you have to answer. And Bahia says, look, you could die anytime, I could die anytime, I need to know. He really wanted to awaken. So the Buddha says, well then, Bahia, you should train yourself like this. So he's telling you how to practice. Whenever you see a form, simply see. Whenever you hear a sound, simply hear. Whenever you smell an aroma, simply smell. Whenever you taste the flavor, simply taste. Whenever you feel a sensation, simply feel. Whenever a thought arises, let it be a thought. So there's just this moment where there's just a sound, and there's no one hearing it. And then there's an inference after the fact, I heard the sound. There's a seeing, and there's this inference that the neural system makes that I'm seeing. He's telling you, don't hold on to anything. If you just move constantly, totally with the present moment, there's no room for the inference to take place. And then he says, then you will not exist. You don't exist because you're not inferring there's a you doing this. It's a creation. It's a fabrication of mind that there's someone outside the experience. So then you will not exist. Whenever you do not exist, you will not be found in this world. Another world or in between. That is the end of suffering. So what does that mean? This world, that world, or world in between. That world is kind of the world outside, the object. This world is the subject seeing. And the world in between is, in Buddhism, consciousness is a very simple thing for the most part. It's simply the knowing that occurs when subject sees object and there's a knowing of it. He's saying none of that will exist if there's simply seeing, simply hearing, simply thinking. Not saying it's my thought. So the story is that Bahia was immediately released from all forms of suffering generated by clinging, craving, aversion, and ignorance. So what keeps us, in some sense, from having this experience of no separation is that we kind of want to get somewhere else. have a better moment. It's actually the last thing that prevents awakening is called restlessness. And it isn't the restlessness of sitting here kind of itchy and all that sort of stuff. It's restlessness in the sense of believing there's any other moment than this very now experience. So there's not only there's no separation, there's not even time. From a psychological perspective, I don't want to get into whatever physics says about time. But there's just this now. This, you know, that's all there is in that moment. Everything else is a creation of mine. So the Buddha's not talking about philosophy here. He's asking to explore our direct experience. Now, this might seem like pretty wild stuff. Let me maybe give a little example that's very poignant for me. I was going through a period where one of my sons was just really going through some horrible stuff. And I walked out of the house, and I was locking the door. And that moment, there was this realization that all there was this sensation of the fingers on the key turning the lock. All the other stuff that was going on, all the thoughts, emotions, projections about what might happen, they were gone for that moment. I see some kind of like, well, this guy's crazy, he looks at me. But you know, it's just do that sometime. Just notice what's actually happening right now. There's an expression, you know, if you're sad, if you're lonely, if you're depressed, be a sad, be a lonely, be a depressed Buddha. Be completely what's there. Now, when I first came to practice and someone said, well, welcome in depression for tea, I thought, yeah. You know, I mean, so sometimes we really have to work at things another way. You know, talking about my experience with my wife, it's like there was a period where she was really involved in other things and we a lot of stuff to deal with. And there was this, even though I was in a marriage, I felt really alone. And then I don't even know how it happened, but I was willing to be with the loneliness. Not just one sitting, but for a long time. Just experience directly what was there. And what happens when one does that is there's no resistance. And loneliness gets to manifest itself. Do what it needs to do, which is arise, be there for a while, and pass away. It's not easy, but that is really a deep aspect of this practice, to really meet what's here. And so a lot of practice is figuring out how to do that, to develop the skill. And part of that skill is this thing I had you do at the beginning, where there's this sense of presence, this here-ness, it's okay. There's a sense of awareness, it simply knows. You know, this awareness is okay. In the midst of discomfort, there's something that has comfort, that's at ease. In the midst of sadness, there's something that can hold that sadness. So in some sense, our practice is not to add anything to it. Larry Rosenberg says, don't add heat, don't add cold. Just experience directly the heat. Even heat's not right, but I got to say something somehow. I was talking to someone who's been practicing quite a while in the elders group. And, you know, when you get older, it's like you're in this pain bag, right? And she said, you know, as soon as you call it pain, you've covered it. What's really happening? There's tension, vibrations, heat, twinging, dynamic process going on. So pain kind of locks it in, makes it a concept, and it's something we don't want. Okay. So in some sense, practice is simply being aware, not simply, because it's not so easy. It is simple, but it's not easy. It's to be with what's actually happening this very moment, not pushing it away, not trying to get to a better place, because there's only now. You know, this judging self that says that you should be a better person, it's taking you out of what's actually here right now. I mean, you can see the judging, and okay, that's a thought. And maybe to come down and what's driving the judging, which is a whole nother talk, but which I've given a couple times, I guess. So I think I want to kind of bring this to an end, and hopefully we can make this pragmatic in the dialogue. And if it's not your thing, then come next week and we can talk about working with emotions. So I want to end because what happens to Bahia, he's awakened, but then he gets gored by a cow protecting his calf and dies. So his spiritual urgency kind of paid off, I guess, because he really didn't have much time. And there's the section of the Pali Canon called the Udana, which is something like the divine utterances or divine sayings of the Buddha. These are these poems that he allegedly composes on the spot. So when he finds out Bahia died, he expresses this poem. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible, there the moon doesn't appear. And there darkness is not found. And when a sage, through wisdom, has realized this from form and formless, then from pleasure and pain, he or she is freed. So what does this poem point to? If you think about water, earth, fire, and wind, it's kind of like in the Buddhist time, it was a measure of what we experience as reality. I mean, now we can talk about quantum physics, but if you actually think about our experiences, we have a sense of heat, we have a sense of groundedness, earth, the wind is the breathing process is going on. So to have no footing is kind of an unusual expression today, but footing is like not to have anything to stand on, no position. You know, someone comes in. Actually, I teach a group in Winchester at a UU church, and some evenings there's another function going on, and it's very noisy. And we have the best discussions after that because people talk about how they were upset by the noise, and they had this notion about how it's supposed to be so quiet. Well, that's footing. It isn't just sound. It's like we grab onto it, and we don't think that the sound should be here. I can imagine you can think of a few things that happened that you don't think should be happening, right? But that's taking a position. Now, sometimes I know that there's going to be an event. One time I knew it was going to be very noisy, and I told people before they came. I sent them an email, okay, it's going to be noisy, just so you know. And afterwards they all said, you know, it wasn't a problem. Because they expected it. And because we talked about, let sound just be sound. Don't bother sound. It's just doing its thing. So then what does this other part mean? There the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible, there the moon doesn't appear. That sounds pretty gloomy, right? But then there's no darkness. And then through wisdom, you're free from form and formless, from pleasure and pain. Now, we probably like to keep the pleasure part, but They kind of go together. It's sort of this dualistic way of seeing the world. It's a quality we infer to things. One thing when one sees things really deeply is this cosmos doesn't have any quality whatsoever. It's just suchness, isness. One of my Zen masters told me, and he didn't talk to me directly, thank God. He said, the universe doesn't care about your opinion. So it's pretty hard to explain what this is saying. There's no moon, there's no, you know, you don't have moon, star, but there's no darkness. But it's like the mind starts discriminating. It stops separating out forms and attributing short, fat, long, tall, good, bad, etc. It's not some philosophical thing. It's something that's experiential. And I think we probably all had it. And maybe part of practice would be to start noticing that, to really take it in. It could be that there's a beautiful sunset. And you notice that moment when you first see it, before you comment on it being beautiful? Is there a you there? It could be, you know, making love or climbing a mountain or dancing or whatever. There's this life flowing. You know, George Mumford has his book out on his experience teaching or helping basketball players, the Chicago Bulls, the Los Angeles Lakers. Now he's trying to help the Knicks. Good luck. and you know, he talks about being in the flow. When do they play the best? It's just when they're not thinking. There's just this movement. So one way to kind of look at there's, you know, we can't, the stars not shining, the sun not being visible, the moon not appearing, is the mind is luminous. It's so bright, it just like, you can't see all those things and there's no darkness. But I think more directly, it's the signlessness of things. What happens is when we see things, then we kind of focus in on them and start attributing qualities to them. So this is pointing to a quiet mind. It's not a meditative mind so much. It's a mind that's not trying to do anything. I mean, it's almost paradoxical. We do all this effort and then see, and then experience, not even see. Then there's this experience when, then you realize there's nothing to do and no one to do it. So it's kind of like we have to beat our head against the wall to realize something that, there it is, just this moment, just now. So I hope I haven't totally looked loco up here, but I think I'll stop there. And if you want to stretch a little bit, then we'll just open up to questions. And it could, anything to do with suffering and its end is relevant, so it does not have to be related to this. So we could talk about emotions if you want, you know, so. So I'll just open up to anybody who wants to maybe. I need someone who wants to use it first.
This is not a question, but you raised this thought in me, something I read a while ago. I think it was in a book, a physics book, but it basically said, this writer said it was amazing that we have an attachment when we think of ourselves, and we think of ourselves as young. We have an attachment to this concept that doesn't exist, that's closer than our attachment to the souls that are around us in the room. That we think of ourselves as separate from whatever's going on in the room and attached to this being. And it just when you talked about mind and concept, it just came up.
Yeah, thank you. You know, actually, there was really a wonderful, you know, one of the things the Buddha teaches is non-clinging. So he say, not clinging to this body as being me, this mind as being me, perceptions, feelings, emotions. So, and there's this guy, Sam, who's in the elders group, who was going through, like a lot of people in the elders group, just going through all kinds of really difficult stuff. And he had a heart attack. I mean, after all kinds of other operations. And he didn't know he had a heart attack. It was a mild heart attack. He drove himself to the hospital. And the surgeon said, "You're having a heart attack." And Sam said, "Who's having a heart attack?" It was very freeing for him. He knew that there wasn't someone who owned this body. It's a belief system. So if you're going to believe something, if you really have to conceptualize something, why don't you believe your everything? It's closer to the truth. You're the coming together of conditions, right? We don't see each other without something to see. Or hear each other without something to hear.
I'll say one more thing that you brought up. I have friends, they are technical people typically, and there's a split in the group between those who believe there's more to us than a program that's running, and those who say that's all we are is just mechanisms that are cause and reaction, and that our image of ourselves is just something that emerges. And what bothers me a little bit in what you were saying is that you're almost you're almost with those people who say we're nothing more than machines, and when you talk about processes and so on.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the Buddha actually tries to avoid all conceptualizations. So, you know, for example, he never really answers whether there's a self or not a self, even though we talk about this teaching of not self. So he's trying to get us to, so even I'm using language because I don't know how else to do that. But I guess what I'm really trying to do is point to something experiential. And so the programming stuff is, I mean, part of practice is to create a healthy sense of self or a healthy sense of healthy programs to feel good. A lot of practice is like that, and it's really important to do that so you can hold things. But then you kind of see through that these are all kind of fabrications. They're programs that we create. We can learn to, we can train ourselves to be loving, we can train ourselves to be kind, compassionate. But they're kind of a training. But then, really, no matter how well we do this, stuff happens, right? 2 weeks ago, somebody hit my car in the parking lot, right? So how equanimous was I when I did, and didn't leave a note? And then I had a bike wreck. You know, it doesn't matter how much I've done in terms of kindness and compassion, you know, and that's just trivial stuff, right? I mean, we start talking about getting diseases, heart attacks, intestinal hemorrhages, you know, despair goes on and on. The stuff happens. And what I'm pointing to is there's something beyond that. Not as an idea, but experientially. That there's something beyond the whole programming process. You know, in some sense, there's a, you know, there's a sunyata, emptiness, that we're together, what we are is the coming together of all kinds of conditions, not just us, but we're not separate from those conditions. We're a manifestation, a particular manifestation of those conditions, and what we really are, it's kind of like the waves on the ocean. You know, we might think we're a wave, but actually there's this whole ocean and we're not separate from it. So that's what I'm trying to point to. I'm not trying to point to something mechanical. And it's not conceptual. you give me an excuse to read Thich Nhat Hanh, as he's been very seriously ill. And he says, "This body is not me. I am not caught in this body. I am life without boundaries. I have never been born and I have never died. Over there, the wide ocean and the sky with many galaxies all manifest from the basis of consciousness. Since beginningless time, I have always been free. Birth and death are only a door through which we go in and out. Birth and death are only a game of hide and seek, so smile to me and take my hand and wave goodbye. Tomorrow we shall meet again, or even before. We shall always be meeting again at the true source, always meeting again on the mirrored paths of life." So what he's saying is, it's like this emptiness, this whole cosmos, or whatever language you want to use, is manifesting as these particular forms, but we're not separate from it. There's nothing solid here. I don't know if that's helpful or not. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm wondering why because I am at times able to, I think, be present in the moment, and it always, even if it's, you know, experiencing sadness, there always seems to be a kind of wholesomeness to it, or sometimes a beauty to it, and yet I will gleefully get lost in some drama. Yeah. And I know what to do. I know it's to notice and come back. But why? Why would I still? Because I feel like I've been meditating on and off for years and years and years and years. And like, why would I still so gleefully get lost in like anger or worry? I just question my motivations, you know, why this would keep happening.
Well, I mean, it's powerful stuff, right? I mean, we've been conditioned for a long time. We've been, you know, you're kind of born and you get called, you're told you're a certain person and you have these qualities, and there's this whole belief system that if we move out in the world, we'll, you know, we all want to be loved and treated kindly and want things to be harmonious and all that sort of thing. I mean, that's actually what's called, when I said the Buddha, the Joshua told me to have no will, this term in Buddhism of craving, it's not like, you know, craving to be someone or to have a sense experience. It's not a decision. It's kind of a reflex, a conditioned way of being. And it's powerful stuff. So, I mean, I had the same thing where I had this, like, really powerful experience at different times. And 7 or 8 years ago, I just realized there was nothing to do and had this 6 weeks of this incredibly vibrant stillness, no separation. I mean, it was, and yet I kind of keep coming back into this separation. And I said, I kind of asked myself, well, why do I do this? And sometimes it's just powerful conditioning. And another part of it is, I think it's helpful to, when you have these moments of clarity of this, really being here, to savor it, to see how sweet it is. That it's so delightful. I mean, there's just, you know, there's teaching of jhanas, these deep states of concentration. There's, I guess, eight of them, four form, four formless. And part of the intention of those is that they're really nice. They really feel good. And the Buddha was a master at it. But he realized they're all conditioned. And so, I mean, that's what we're talking about, the unconditioned, which is this kind of not trying to do anything, really. And yet things happen. Life does it itself. So, you know, the jhanas are to gradually give up things because there's something that's so much sweeter than going out in the sense world and stuff. So it's a real, it takes time, you know? Yeah. So I think, and, you know, there's the expression, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. It's like at some point you kind of see this, but then we have to work with all the stuff that we'll talk about next week, all the emotions and things like that. You know, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for the talk. I saw it most what you're talking about. most manifest over the holiday weekend. I went on a picnic with three little girls and an infant, and the four-year-old was very went to one of those splashy fountains, and would strip down nude and then put on a bathing suit and run in the water and then come out and do it again, and then we'd go into the another area, and she just would start talking to the flowers and just touching each one, and as if all of us had disappeared. The baby was craving, as babies do, fussing, and her older sisters were fussing over this blanket and that blanket, and this is mine and that's yours. And she was, very happily in and out of this, just not caring about all of that, mine, yours, and this and that, and just accepting the moment. And she, I watched her for a long time, just happily touching, talking to the flowers, and like she disappeared, or we disappeared. And I'm like, wow. Right. Yeah. So that's where I saw it most powerfully, that you can just exist in the world but not really be so concerned about who you are or what the flower is or how you got there or are you hungry, because when she was hungry, she just came and got something to eat and then went back talking to and counting and whatever she was. I had no idea what she was discussing with the flowers, but I didn't want to interrupt her. She was very serious, and so it's that kind of quality I've seen. Yeah. So I guess if we could get back to that middle stage of between conscious, conditioning and the craving of infancy, that'd be a great place to be.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I was going to read a poem by Joshua where he said, one of the lines is, as a butterfly lost in a flower. So he's not watching the butterfly. There's just this butterfly lost in a flower, and he's not separate from it. And I think what happens, we do have to have concepts. I better know where CIMC is, and I'm supposed to give a talk tonight, right? But they're functional. I need to know I, might have to plan to have food or all this sort of thing. But what happens is we turn these concepts into all kinds of things we should be, projections of the future. I mean, we even have to think about the future, but not 10,000 times. Yeah, so thanks, yeah. Up here, please. Yep.
Hello. I really enjoyed your talk. And I really enjoyed when you brought up the poem about suffering and how to end it. And in my mind, I think of formulas for things and formulas to get the right answer to things, like similar to that, but not in a poetic way. Like if I want a job, what is the most skillful way to go about this? And I don't know, it was funny when you were reading the poem, because I was like, this is, I don't know, almost like a formula, but not.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you do have to do things to get a job, right? But then can you see that it's a function? That you're in this environment and there's certain things you need to do. But then not to be like there's a me who didn't do it right or got approved or didn't get approved or all that unnecessary stuff that gets laid on top of it. And so it's like, if I give a talk, can I walk out of this talk and not be sort of reflect back on, I do reflect back on, because I like to be more grounded than I am, but it's always hard to be down here when you're trying to think about what to say. But maybe just reflect on it, but then not lay on all this judgment. Like, this mind-body process just did what it could do at that moment. Yeah. So it's like you go out into a job and you go through an interview and you have certain skills and you have certain intelligence and you're maybe you got a good night's sleep the night before, you didn't get a good night's sleep. Or, I mean, all these things, conditions come together that determine what's going to happen rather than there's a you here who should, yeah.
I also wanted to add, like, is there a formula for not suffering?
Yeah. Be here now. It's really totally opening to the moment. And I mean, I actually had an interesting, I taught the elders group Tuesday, and a lot of times we're told to accept or allow things. And people got, one person was an activist, a very bright guy, and he really had trouble with that. And I thought it was interesting because, and I exchanged an email from Ryan, and she said she'll think about this, because the Buddha never used that language. He said, don't cling. So if you want a formula, don't cling. Don't cling to this body is yours. Don't cling to this mind is yours. These emotions is yours. I mean, that's no footing. Not holding on to things. Just to go with the flow. There's a wonderful story Larry Rosenberg used to tell about, what's the name of the movie? There's a Greek. What's the, anybody help me with this? Greeks? Yeah, what is it? Zorba the Greek, yeah. And he tells a story about Zorba the Greek where they're building all these sluices to bring down logs. And they've been working on it for a long time. And they're having a celebration. And they're cooking lamb. And they start setting the logs down and the sluice just falls apart. And people are all moaning and stuff. And Zorba says, the lamb's burning. So it's like not kind of, things happen. Yeah. That's the formula is just don't cling. Yes? Which isn't easy, of course. I can't say I was totally equanimous when I came out and saw somebody smash my car, you know. took me a few hours to... Okay. All right. Can't see. Can we? I should have gotten the other mic out, but at this point it's too late to bother, I guess. So,
it's like a relay race. So just to follow up on the don't cling concept, I mean, it's easy to say don't cling, and there's a lot of times where, you know, you could take a moment and pause and relax and let go. But through practice, or through my practice, becoming aware of the real deeper clinging that, you know, in the core of our perception and the core of how we function in the world, or how I function in the world, it seems like I'm aware of the clinging. And I know the clinging is causing the suffering, particularly when I'm off the mat, but I'm just unable to uncling. It just has a mind of its own. It's just kind of like when you're just this death grasp or something.
Yeah.
It's just cannot think it, you know, think it away, cannot really relax it away. It's just...
Yeah.
I don't know how to approach that.
Just allow it to be that. In other words, just there's clinging. Can you open to the clinging? I mean, it's not a really nice answer, but that's it, right? It's like if we have aversion, then open to the aversion. If we're holding on to something, just to be with it directly. Because as soon as you try and get rid of it, you're creating a sense of me. Who doesn't, I mean, it's one part of you fighting another part of you, right? There's a part of you that's clinging, and there's a part that doesn't want that to happen. So it's an internal fight going on. And so the practice is to see, to allow this awareness to hold that. In other words, it's just stepping back and simply seeing, ah, clinging's happening, and there's aversion to the clinging. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of hard to stay with the clinging when they're like clinging so charged with a lot of emotions or...
Right.
And it's funny because it's even like the body or the mind. Body, from when I sit, has a natural tendency to kind of just avoid or distance or numb itself. So it's hard. It's like I want to fully experience it.
Right.
I really want to get close to it. But there's just this inner defense mechanism that just somehow not allowing me that.
Right. So I want to try and talk about this a lot more detail next week. But I mean, part of it is to see, or not to see, but to see if you can come into the body, really, and maybe notice where the aversion is rather than the headpiece, because the headpiece. What happens is that we go up in the head because we don't want to feel the emotions that are driving it. So the first thing is to kind of notice, like, oh, there are all these thoughts coming around that I don't want this. And then see if you can come into the body and be aware of the breathing. And this is, I was listening to a talk by Narayan because I was trying to think about different ways. I like to listen to other people, how they talk about how we work with things. And she said, you know, when we talk about difficult emotions and then somebody tells you to come to the breathing process, and the reaction is, if you're new in practice, is like, that's all there is, this little breath, and that's what I'm supposed to use for a ground. So a lot of purpose of practice is to really develop some stability. Like that the whole body breathing process become a refuge. And it's not easy. I mean, I've sat with adrenaline flowing over incredibly stupid stuff because underneath it, there are what Buddhists call latent tendencies. There's all this conditioning, things that happened a long, long time ago have nothing to do with a particular situation that need to be released. And so the instinct is to fix things, try and get rid of it. But the problem is that might sort of assuage things a little bit, but it doesn't bring the underlying causes to an end. And so it's not easy. And there are other things you can do, like you can maybe do some walking rhythmically. Sometimes it's just actually bringing compassion to it. I remember one time I had this experience where I was on a long retreat and some teacher did something that was actually pretty unskillful, but I overreacted to it. I mean, not to them directly, but internally. And I'm pretty skilled at stuff, right? It didn't matter. The adrenaline was going, I'm going to straighten this person out, blah, 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 blah. I'm walking, it didn't help. And then I just thought, there's this defender here that's playing this role. And I just brought compassion to it. You know, sometimes even using phrases like, I care for my sorrow or anger or whatever. So,
yeah. Okay, I'll be here next week.
Okay. Back in by Bob there. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for your talk. So I was surprised that you described sort of this notion of realizing no separation as a sweetness, because it seems like in some sense calling it that is just another label, right? So yep, I'm wondering, absolutely, if you can elaborate.
Well, I remember when I first had the experience and I'd kind of lie in bed at night and try and think about how to describe it. And I realized there was really no way to describe it because there's no you there when it's happening. It's like the mind's just not moving. I mean, it's not like it's shut down. It's not focused on something. There's just, I don't know, suchness would be a good word for it, really. Sometimes the language is used as stillness, which I think for me, and probably for a lot of people actually, is a really apt description of what the experience is like. I actually wrestled with whether to read another discourse at the end than the one I did. It's if you get Rodney Smith's book, Stepping Out of Self-Deception, it's in there. And it goes something like, for those who cling, there is motion. For those who cling not, there is no motion. When there is no motion, there is no craving, which is, from the Buddhist perspective, the cause of suffering. And then he goes on to say, when there's no craving, there's no coming or going, which is a sense of creating a self. We're always becoming, is like we're trying to be someone, right? So now it's saying there isn't any coming or going. There's no time. And then I'm missing something here. But then it ends up with, there's neither this world nor that world or world in between as truly as the end of suffering. So it ends exactly the same way the Bahia Sutta does. But basically there's no time. There's no space. There's no separation. They're all just pointers.
Right.
Yeah. And sweet, you know, you're right.
It's hard though, because the little tastes I've had of that in my practice are such that I do feel like there's this positivity to it too. Yeah. And that's how I identify with the notion of sweetness. But I think that's been a challenge for me, is how to understand that it is what it is, but then that what it is good, but then that's a label. So
You don't label it. That's the thing. You know, I mean, and it's really fascinating if you read some of the discourses with some of the Buddhist best disciples. He kind of like jumps all over them in a way. There's a wonderful story about, I'll quit after this, but there's a wonderful story about this guy who's got these great meditative skills. And he said, yet I don't realize the deathless. And Sariputta, who's the Buddha's number one disciple, says, well, your problem is conceit. There's a sense of me who wants to get somewhere. I mean, there were actually two other problems. I can't remember what they were. But he just points out directly, like, you're not free because, you know, there's still this you who's got to have something. So we can't, I mean, you know, we get up here and we talk, we kind of have to say something, I guess. Or actually, I remember I had a discussion with Narayan. She said, I wish, you know, the Buddha just held up a flower. And she said, I wish we could do that in some sense. Yeah, so thanks. So I'm really happy to stay around and talk with people, but for those who, it is 8:45, so people who want to go, please do. It was a delight to spend the evening with you. Thank you. Yeah.
One final announcement. It would be greatly appreciated if folks could help set the room up for tomorrow by removing the last three rows of mats and cushions and stacking them in the front left corner. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.